This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 7. And before we get to today's episode, I want to just say welcome to any new listeners. We appreciate that you found our show, but I also wanted to say thank you to those that have been listening. I've been really pleasantly surprised by the response that I've received, both the feedback that I've received, but also just by, you know, how many listens we're getting and where they're coming from, all over the world. We're blowing up in Sweden. Who would have thought? Hello, Sweden. We appreciate you listening. Canada, Australia, and of course the United States. And it's just been really exciting to see that happening, and it inspires me and wants me to inspires me to keep doing a better job. So thank you for that. So and in that theme, I'm really excited about today's show, and I think you will be as well. I have a special guest, Laurel Solomon, who I got to spend some time with talking about how she facilitates conversations, supervises, does workshops around oppression theory and social justice, or applying the social justice lens to our clinical practices. And I met her initially earlier this year at the American Family Therapy Academy Conference, the AFTA conference that was held in June in Vancouver, Washington, earlier this year. And she gave a workshop that was just packed and generated a ton of conversation. She didn't even get to finish her framework, so I wanted to give her an opportunity to do that here on this show, but in that conversation, in that workshop, because there was so much conversation. So a little bit about Laurel Solomon. She is a New York State licensed marriage and family therapist. She is the program supervisor at Steinway Child and Family Services in the Bronx, New York, and she's also an adjunct professor at Mercy College. And Laurel is passionate about exploring and understanding how oppression impacts clinical work and how culture influences what we think about people, how we treat them, and how people expect to be treated by us. And she does a lot of workshops, trainings, and definitely supervision. And if you're interested in getting plugged into some of that, I will have her information at the end of the show. So without further ado, let's get to the interview with Laurel. Well, welcome to the show, Laurel. I'm really excited to have you here.
Hi, Chris. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. Thank you for taking the time. I know you are a busy person. I want to just tell our listeners, just for the sake of how I came to know about you and your work, I attended earlier this year. I went to the American Family Therapy Conference in Vancouver, Washington, the AFTA conference, and you were doing a workshop on teaching oppression theory, and I attended that workshop, and it was such a, I want to say, rich conversation that you were presenting on, which we're going to talk about today. You were presenting on your teaching oppression theory framework, these 10 points that you were presenting to the group. But
right, for facilitating conversation.
Yep, exactly. And it was such a rich conversation that you actually didn't get through your framework. I think you got maybe.
No, I never did. I never got to finish.
Yeah, I think you got to point 3 or 4 or something like that. And then and just we ran out of time. And so it was just a really great conversation. And so and it just stuck with me. Well, it was one of the main pieces that I attended during that conference that really stuck with me. So I wanted to reach back out to you and talk about that framework and how you use that in supervision, how you use that working with families. But before we do that, I maybe wanted just to ask you, how did you come into this work, or how did you adopt the social justice lens, or how did you become passionate about facilitating conversations around oppression theory?
It's funny because it all kind of happened at the same time. I worked in a completely different field for a long time.
Oh, you did?
But I was always interested in like racism and sexism, just because growing up as a Black woman, like it was stuff that I always experienced. And I worked in a completely different industry, and I had always kind of wanted to be a therapist. So in 2010, I decided to go to graduate school, and I knew I was going to need an internship. And I knew that there was an agency near me called Volunteer Counseling Services. And I went and I applied to be a volunteer there for a year while I was in my first year of graduate school before internship or anything like that. And they had this really interesting community change program that had all of these different social justice projects that you could work in.
Oh, wow.
And they do a really extensive training. And I went through their training and I started to do all this work in these projects that they had at the same time I was going to graduate school.
Hmm.
So what happened was everything that I learned at school was shaped through the social justice lens.
Everything.
Like from the very beginning.
Wow.
Yeah, I started training. I took my first class the same week that I started the training there.
Wow.
So everything that I always learned always went through that oppression theory. And I already had ideas about it just from like my own life. Like, for example, my mother worked in a school where she was like the only black school teacher. And I remember like all these experiences that she would have and these stories that I always grew up with. So I knew that there was like a lot of stuff that was happening that maybe people didn't see or didn't understand. And I also knew that growing up, it wasn't a conversation we really had. Like, this is not something that you talked about outside of like your own community. Like, I knew like as a woman growing up, like we didn't talk about sexism with men. I knew as a black person growing up, we really didn't talk about racism with other people that weren't black. So all of a sudden I went to VCS and we started to have these discussions, and all of the training was this very discussion-based type of training. And we were having these conversations in these groups, and I started to see like how powerful that was. And I also realized that there was no place else where this was really happening. So as I went through school, everything that I did, I always kept this in the back of my mind. Like, how can I do this? How can I spread this? How can I go other places and have these conversations? So that's kind of where, like, the passion really started.
Great. Okay. And how did you come about formulating? I imagine that you started to teach or you started to supervise or those kinds of things. How did you come about formulating your particular framework for facilitating these kinds of conversations?
So for facilitating the conversations, what actually happened is I worked in a batterer program. And one of the main things that we did in this program, we were working with men who were mandated by the courts for domestic violence. And I had been trained a lot about domestic violence and how it kind of ties to sexism and this idea that it's okay to treat women in certain ways that it wouldn't be okay to treat other people. And we would have a lot of discussions in that group. And it was mostly about facilitating conversations about sexism. And then something that was going on with the courts where I was, is I noticed we were getting a lot of men in the program that were men of color. And it's not because they were committing crimes at a higher rate, but it was because the way the justice system is structured, they were definitely being penalized more.
Yeah.
And I started to draw parallels between the racism and the sexism with the men in the classes.
Wow.
And that's when I started to first get this idea of like, well, how do we, this is another way that I'm always having these conversations. We're having conversations with this group, and this is how we're doing it. And we were having really great conversations about sexism, about racism. Then we were having conversations about heterosexism and how they all kind of work the same way, that they have these same rules.
Wow.
And
what kind of responses were you getting from the men in these groups?
What I found with the men in the program is that they were having a very hard time seeing sexism because it's not something that they're the target of. But the men of color absolutely saw racism because they experience that all the time. And when I started to talk about the way racism and sexism work the same way, they started to get it. Then they started to make a connection like, oh, that does make sense. And I also talked a lot about the idea that when you're the target of a certain oppression, you see it. And people who aren't the target of it maybe don't necessarily see it. And we would have conversations about when you try to talk about something racist that happened in a room, and sometimes a white person might say to you, oh, well, I didn't see that, and what that experience is like. And then I would kind of flip it. Well, this is how sexism works. That something is going on, and you could be sitting right there, and you don't see it because it's not directed at you. And you're not super experienced at always recognizing it, right? When you're the target of it, you know how to recognize it because you have to kind of – that's how you survive.
Wow.
And it started to make this big connection. I saw it with the men in the class. So I started to see it.
That's really fascinating to me. So you were really making a lot. First, you were operating on a lot of different intersections, right? And then making a lot of these things visible that were invisible at the time, right?
Absolutely. And that was part of the training that I had there. I had fantastic training at VCS.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so Would now be an okay time to go into your framework a little bit and kind of talk about how you conceptualize facilitating these conversations and your strategies for doing that?
Absolutely. So one of the first things that I always do when I start to even have any kind of discussion about this, so like with my interns, for example, I started them with the first day when they came in with this discussion about what oppression really is. So the first thing I always do is I give a really basic structure of how oppression works. And it's a dynamic between two groups. There's a dominating group and there's a marginalized group. And I like that language, and that's language that I got through my training at VCS, this idea that a group is not like, because very often you'll hear people talk about like minority groups.
Right.
A minority, first of all, has all kinds of like negative implications. And then also it's a numerical idea. And then people will talk about, well, I'm the minority like in this, you know what I mean? Without really understanding that it's really about something that's being done to a group of people. So that's why we kind of use marginalized groups. And then I talk about the rules of what dominating groups do to marginalized groups. So some of the things that are always done are things like defining and diminishing the experience of people in marginalized groups.
Right.
Things like silencing people. And then things, big things that are easy to see, like dictating rights unequally or determining resources.
Which we're seeing in the current events. Currently,
yeah, absolutely.
Which you do access a lot of current events as a way, as a teaching tool, as I understand it, correct?
Absolutely. It's actually, once I do the whole framework and I go through all the rules, I use a lot of current events to find examples.
Great.
Of it.
Okay.
So one of the things, for example, with students and also with my interns, one of the things that we did is we talked about things like the whole Ray Rice story and domestic violence and the way it was handled and the way that we automatically defined the experience of his partner, the way that we silenced her, the way that we kind of forced her to justify herself, right? In which case, then we're not even talking about what he did. It became, the whole main story became about what she did. And then at the end, it became about like, oh, maybe we're penalizing him too hard, which is like a funny little way that we kind of deal with domestic violence in this country. Mm. Even though we think that that's not how it's handled, that tends to be the way it's handled all the time. A lot of people were outraged by the way the NFL handled it, but it's kind of the way that we handle domestic violence in most situations. So that's an interesting little thing. We talked about Bill Cosby. And like the different, like the way the women were treated when they were coming out, and this idea that it was so easy to dismiss what they were saying for like all various different reasons.
Right.
Talked about silencing, all the different techniques of silencing them.
Well, and
so yeah. I find current events to be really helpful.
And so, and I'm thinking, and correct me if this is inaccurate, but I'm thinking of another way of silencing is the idea of this Black Lives Matter, but then there's this other voice of, well, all lives matter, right? And would you put that in like the silencing category or just kind of defining and diminishing the experience in some ways?
Yeah, I think actually 100%. It's funny because I was thinking about that today when I was thinking about one of the things I was going to talk to you about today. So I love that you brought that
up. Okay, well, we can get back to that. But so what are some of the other things the dominating group? Because you did have a really a handout that I actually use so for what dominating groups do to marginalized groups. And so define and diminish, silence, and what else?
All right, so dictate their rights unequally.
Right.
Right. And we see that with racism, with sexism, with heterosexism. We see it across the
right.
line. Determine their resources. So an interesting example of this is specifically with things like the way that we handle funding for things that we look at as a society's problem. So for domestic violence, for example, a lot of the funding goes to giving programs for women, right? About like, oh, this is how you don't get abused. Hmm. Right. Or we do this with sexual assault. This is how, like, you protect yourself from being assaulted. But we don't really, where are all the resources that teach men not to do
Interesting,
this?
Interesting, yeah.
You know what I mean? We act like it's a women's problem, like domestic violence or rape. But who's the one doing all of the raping?
Right.
And there's not, like, a lot of funding directed that way. So that's, like, an idea of the way that we kind of determine resources. Another thing that dominating groups do to marginalized groups is they force them to justify themselves. You know, like, explain to me why this was racist. Explain to me why this was sexist. Explain to me why it's homophobic. Make me understand it. Like, package it in a way that makes sense to me. And if you're not able to do that, then it's like, oh, well, then it no longer is valid.
Yeah. And it just keeps putting the burden back on the marginalized group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you said something about blaming them for being oppressed as well. Can you expand on that as well?
Sure, absolutely. With sexism, we often blame women for acting in ways, or for example, with domestic violence, this was a very big thing with the Ray Rice case, just blaming women for acting in ways that somehow provoke abuse.
Yeah, right.
Right. But if the man was not abusive, it wouldn't matter what she did. Mm. With people of color, a lot of the discussion about things happening with the police, there's always like, well, you know, if you just did exactly what you were supposed to do in that situation, then maybe you wouldn't be killed by the police. But like, there is no perfect way to behave to prevent somebody from doing something that's abusive to
right.
you.
But the blame shows up anyway. And then I think finally you had pretend the system doesn't exist.
Right, which is the main thing. And with racism, I see that a lot. The people will say, well, there's racism. But then whenever we actually call out someone for being racist, then it's like, no. Well, that's not what they meant. It's this kind of idea that, like, there's racism, but there are no racists.
Yeah, okay.
Like, no one's ever right. racist. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, well, then where is it coming from? So then it becomes this kind of like, well, it's just maybe that they're being sensitive and it's not really something that's
right.
happening.
And I see a lot of talk about PC culture. There's this like pushback about, well, yeah, it's just an interesting pushback that I think could fall into that category of pretending this system doesn't exist and even diminishing the experience. And I'm sure that's going to continue on. So now,
absolutely, because now there's this whole, there's actually like a trend of people who are actually doing the oppressing saying that they're being persecuted, because like now it's not okay for them to be as oppressive as they were before.
Yeah. And I think you're seeing a lot of that.
So it's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Kind of this co-opting that's happening. It's interesting. Okay, so now about your framework for facilitating conversations about oppression. You have kind of this 10-point framework, which I felt was really helpful. Do you want to kind of maybe start with that, or you want me to ask you about that? I know the first one is this idea of a deep understanding of oppression theory. Yeah, and how would we as educators, or how do we acquire that deeper understanding, or how would you suggest that, you know, those of us that want to do better jobs at teaching oppression and adapting social justice lens and helping our students navigate those kinds of things, how would you recommend we get that deeper understanding?
I think having conversations for me work the best. I know some people like to do a lot of reading and things like that, but I feel like there's so much nuance that comes out in having conversations, because you start to really apply these rules to real life concepts, to things that are going on. You start to have nuances. So having conversations with like-minded people, I find, is the best way to really develop your understanding of oppression. And even as I was teaching this, as long as I have these rules, I have this framework, I can see when I'm not, where my opinion about something, maybe like my personal belief about something, maybe doesn't necessarily line up. And then being open to really seeing where you're maybe a little bit off.
Right. Okay. Which is hard work, I think, in this day and age.
Very hard work.
to be really reflective in that way. And yeah, so.
It's often really uncomfortable,
exactly.
too, because it means sometimes looking at your own biases.
Exactly.
About things, which we all have
right.
them.
Exactly. And the second point, I really appreciate this one, and that's that idea of managing your energy. This idea of how you approach these kinds of conversations, I think, is so important. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think for me, this is probably the biggest one, because for me, and it's really the first one, because I think that having the understanding is kind of like it's kind of an obvious point, but the manager energy was like where I really started to build the list.
Right.
Because I know for me, when you're very passionate about something, when you have really strong feelings about something, that comes out in the way that you speak. It comes out in the way that you are even sitting when you're talking with a group of people. And if your energy is high, then people will automatically respond to you with high energy. And this is already a really emotionally charged type of topic.
Sure.
And this is something that I absolutely 100% learned during my internship. I learned with my mentor at this program, this manager energy. This is something that she always said to me, something that she always practices, this idea of really just take a deep breath and like calm down. Remember what your role is at the time. Your role is not to make everyone agree with you. Your role is just to really hear people and help them to process that out until they, because most of us, when we're having these conversations, we're earnestly having these conversations for good reasons.
Sure. Yeah.
And just always remembering that, and not like coming across as attacking people, because people are going to think that you're doing that anyway. Very often I notice with this type of work. So, or this type of topic, people will feel kind of, so you really just have to manage your energy, take a deep breath, just let the conversation happen.
Right. One more time, sit in uncomfortability, right? Or potentially uncomfortability. The third point is don't let people in the dominating groups control the conversation. Which is a tricky one, and I'm sure you probably have a lot of experience having to try and facilitate that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's incredibly tricky, because that's the kind of the way our whole system works. So to expect it to not play out in a group is just, like, we have to assume that it's going to happen. So this is also, like, when I was working in a battle program where it was me and maybe one other facilitator, sometimes me alone, with a group of, like, 25 men, and I'm talking to them about sexism, I have to figure out a way to maintain my authority in the room. I have to figure out a way to not necessarily be kind of controlled by, like, all of these different techniques that society gives them to shut me out.
Right.
So that's kind of how it starts. And then this is something that will play out in groups. So if you're in a group, for example, I go to a training called Undoing Racism that's about racism, and it's a very mixed group. It's a big group. And very often what will happen is people of color are afraid to speak, and white people will talk a lot, and they kind of fill up all the space, and then we're not really hearing the experiences of people of color who are talking about being oppressed.
Right.
So it's this idea of the way that I usually manage that is I talk about this. This is what happens. I talk about the silencing. If it actually happens, which I think this is one of the tips later on, that if it actually happens in the room, I discuss it in that moment. Well, let's talk about what just happened here. Let's talk about how this person was talking and maybe we weren't all hearing her or we weren't all hearing him. Let's talk about how the last four people that spoke were all men.
Right.
Or the last four people that spoke were all white people. Let's talk about that. Like, I just always bring it up and say, like, these are the politics that are always at play.
Right.
So let's talk about how they're playing out now in the group.
Do you find people, when you make that visible, do you find people struggle with that, that they had been taking up a lot of space in the room? Or how do you handle that?
People do struggle with it, and I also just acknowledge that.
Right.
And that's where, like, my therapy skills kind of come
right.
into play, because I'll acknowledge that. Like, I know this is difficult.
Right.
I know this is a struggle. I know this is uncomfortable. I'm looking at on the wall in my office right now. I actually have a poster on the wall that says, if you never feel uncomfortable in therapy, then you're doing it wrong. And it's kind of, you know, it's the same idea. Like, it's going to be uncomfortable, and that's okay. And we're all uncomfortable. So, like, let's just be okay with that. With my students, very often I would talk about that also, because people start to feel like, well, I can't say anything because, like, they don't let us talk, right?
Right.
Or then it becomes, well, if we are talking too much, then people are going to be mad. Like, it always comes up. So I just always just identify it. I always put it out there.
Okay. Right. Okay. So the fourth point is, don't force people in marginalized groups to justify themselves to the people in dominating group.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm thinking it's, you know, we can fall into this trap when we're asking maybe a person of color to speak for a community as a whole kind of thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of how you're conceptualizing that, or one of the ways?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely, that's one way that it often happens, where it says, well, what about, like, the black people that I see on the train that do this? And all of a sudden you become the spokesperson for your everybody,
yeah, right?
Right. And then you also become, like, responsible for justifying their behavior. You
right.
know what I mean? Just to explain why that is, like, somehow okay.
Right.
So that's a trap that I think we often fall into, because that's kind of what happens with this oppression anyway. So it's just this, again, playing out in the room. Well, explain to me why, like, those two women from Black Lives Matter, why they spoke to Bernie Sanders that way. Like, 25 people have asked that question. You know what I mean? Like, things like that come up all the
right.
time. So, and it's not a good place to be coming from a conversation. It's also halting that those dominating group and marginalized group behaviors while they're happening right in front of you. So it's saying, this is something that often happens. How about we just assume that this is the case instead of forcing people to justify it, forcing people to explain it until you feel it's valid, right? Because that's oppression acting out right there, that someone says, this is my experience. Well, help me understand it more. Tell me more. I don't know if that really makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what happens.
Okay. And number five is, don't make it personal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. These kinds of conversations can hit really close to home, I imagine, and somehow. And I think in your description of that, you talked about it in kind of a very externalized way of, like, talking about these things more as themes, or you know, just kind of externalizing them in a way that it moves it further away from the personal in some way.
Well, I think that if you're in a dominating group. And I know that they're dominating groups that I fall into. And when you're in a dominating group, you very quickly want to say, well, I don't do that.
Yeah, right.
Right? Right. And as soon as you get caught in the, well, I don't do that, then you're missing the picture. Because oppression in general is not about interactions between two people.
Yeah, right.
Right? Like, if I can convince one person on Facebook, like in Minnesota, that racism is real, that doesn't really impact my life.
Right.
It's the system that creates the problem. And then we're all just kind of playing it out. So
right.
we're just playing out the system that's already there. So that's why I try not to make it personal, because people get very caught up in saying, well, I'm a good straight person. I don't do those things. Right. But that doesn't mean that they're not acting in ways or benefiting from their privilege because they're straight.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's about the whole system. It's not about our individual interactions. Our individual interactions are examples of the big system, but it's not about us personally. Because as soon as you make it personal, people get defensive, people feel guilty,
yeah.
and that blocks them from really hearing what's going
right.
on.
And but you found some success in locating it back into the system, and yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. On your sixth point, you try to have facilitators who represent both, and I think this is really interesting. And on just on a side note, I think I'm experimenting that with this at my clinic around having a couple of people in couples therapy sessions. But this idea of try to have facilitators who represent both marginalized and dominating groups whenever it's possible. Hard to do, I think, but
yes, absolutely hard to do. But if you have any ability to do it,
And what's your experience been with that? Or
so I find that, whether we want it to be the case or not, a person in a dominating group just tends to have a little bit more authority when they're talking about oppression. So, for example, when I'm talking to my students about sexism, and then my friend, who is also a facilitator in my batterer program, who is a man, comes and says the same thing, they hear it more from him because he's not somebody in the group. Now, that's not great. That's not convenient. That kind of sucks. And it's symbolic of the whole system, right?
Right.
But it helps to have that other person, because I will always automatically be dismissed a little bit talking about the oppression because of the way the system works, right? When I come into like a classroom on the first day and I say, we're going to talk about racism, they're like, oh, great, this is another black person talking about racism.
Right.
And then I have to work even harder to get through
right.
that.
Right.
I do, and I manage with it, but it helps. The other thing that you want to watch for is this, going back to this idea of justifying. If you're both of your facilitators are people in a marginalized group, and a person in a dominating group who is in the group is like kind of coming at them, as a facilitator, you have to be able to respond to these things, but you don't want to then fall into that position where you're like trying to package it in a way that makes it okay for that person in the dominating group.
Mm.
So it just kind of takes that extra little piece of politics out of it.
Interesting, yeah. Okay. And I think there's a lot there, just even in other contexts as well. Like I said, within couples therapy, we're experimenting, at least with heterosexual couples, doing some co-therapy, both with male-female therapists, that kind of thing. So, I think there's some interesting potentials there. So, okay, going on. Number seven, you require participants to be respectful. Seems like a no-brainer, but can be difficult at times, I think, right?
Yeah, I think it seems like a no-brainer, but it absolutely, things get really heated.
Yep.
And we're also told that we're not supposed to talk about these things,
right?
Like, this is the stuff we don't talk about. So when we do talk about it, sometimes everything starts coming out. And sometimes it comes out in ways that are not respectful. Sometimes, and as soon as we get into that disrespect, as soon as people are arguing with each other, like, that's it. The conversation's over. You're not really having a conversation anymore. And this happens, like, in counseling, you know this happens too. As soon as, like, you're both defending yourselves.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, nothing else is going on but the defending.
Right.
So I think it's the same principle.
Okay. And then your eighth point is keep it simple. Can you tell me a little bit about keep it simple?
So oppression is a very, very deep, very layered idea. There's all kinds of intersectionality with depression. Depression. There's like all kinds, like there are so many different levels to it. And the more that I learn about it, the more I talk about it, the more I study it, the further and further and further the implications go. That doesn't mean that you start there on the first day. On the first day, you do dominating groups, marginalized groups. This is how it works.
Right. Yeah, I think you said something about...
And help people understand. Yeah,
you said something about start at oppression 101, not oppression 501, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is actually, that's something that one of my co-facilitators used to always say, that she and I would get into these really deep conversations about this, and then we would go teach a class, and we would start to bring up, and we would see the men in the class looking at us like, what are they talking
right.
about? And we would say, okay, we got to back it up. Let's back up. Let's keep it simple.
Okay. And number nine, your ninth point, is which we already kind of touched on, but there might be more room for that. That idea of addressing oppression that occurs in the room, and that's kind of really here and now, and in some sort of way, making it visible in the moment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the keys with this also that I find is oppression, when it happens in the room, people notice it. Whether we talk about it or not, people notice
sure.
it.
Sure, yeah.
Right? If you're in a meeting and a man starts talking over a woman, the other women see it. people notice it. And if you don't talk about it, you kind of lose a little bit of your credibility with this, right? So I feel like it's important to discuss it. It's important to always be accountable to what's happening. And then as soon as you point it out, immediately go to broad terms with
well,
it.
Well,
right? Because the goal is never to make it about your bad.
The person, right.
You did this wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And I'm thinking of, I had an experience in your workshop at AFTA, and where somebody, after a lot of conversation, somebody checked in with me being a white male, and then somebody kind of, you know, made notice that, here we are checking in with the white person, making sure he's okay with this difficult conversation. And that was kind of going on. And so it was just kind of interesting. I got to see it in action in that moment. And you know, it brought up a lot of different feelings for me, you know, and as to be expected. And, you know, but, you know, I often think that because of my, you know, privilege, what have you, I think that a lot of my task is sitting in these kinds of difficult conversations. That's because I have the privilege of not having to sit in those difficult conversations. So,
exactly. Yeah. And, right. When the conversation's over, you can just leave.
Exactly.
Right. For some of us, we're still in that conversation all
exactly.
the time.
Exactly. So that was a real learning experience for me, and seeing that in action, that, you know, making it visible in the room. And finally, on your 10th point, you said, don't expect to win over everyone or for everyone to get it. Yeah. It's tough, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, that's a futile experiment, and it's one that I have absolutely fallen into. Like, I'm going to have every student walk out of here feeling that, like, they understand all, and that's just not going to happen.
Right.
You know, but, like, for every student who said, like, I had a student who said I gave a one-sided view of rape. For every student who says that.
In your evaluation? Wow.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, well, I'll take that.
Yeah, right.
You know, but for every student that says that, I get like an email from another one who was like, oh my God, did you see this thing that just happened? And it made me think about our class two semesters ago. Like,
yeah.
So that's what you just have to reach some people. And you also just, for me to be accountable to myself, I have to do the work, whether they get it or not.
Right. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and
those emails, like you said, and even with me, I mean, I'm an example of like still being affected by your workshop and wanting to continue the conversation and, okay, so now in clinical supervision, you've kind of developed this framework, you've developed it in your groups and for your, I imagine you do teaching at Mercy College in their MFT program,
yes.
Correct? Yeah. And so...
In the undergrad program.
In their undergrad program, okay. But I also know in clinical supervision, how's it been kind of adapting this framework in clinical supervision and working with trainees and interns and adopting this kind of the oppression lens or a social justice lens?
So what I actually did with our interns here, I have a separate supervision group just for oppression.
Okay.
So this way it takes it out of just talking about like all the basic stuff that you talk about with cases,
sure.
Because that can fill up, you know, that fills up your whole time. So I have a second supervision group and we meet for an hour, and I actually started it very similar to this conversation that we had. I gave them all that same handout that I gave at the workshop with all of the rules. This is how it works. And we do a discussion. So we talk about cases, we talk about current events, and then we also talk about how we can apply this oppression theory to our actual work. So I have four like main questions that we always cover for each client as they come in the beginning. And what I did is I started this with them before they even really had cases. They started like their second week of internship.
So can you share those four questions?
Mm-hmm,
okay,
absolutely.
Great.
Right. So the four questions are, what are the common stereotypes about each of the groups that our client falls into?
Okay.
What are the dynamics between me and this client because of oppression? How might I inadvertently oppress this client if I'm not careful? And how are the client's current presenting problems related to oppression?
Mm-hmm. So you really make an effort to locate a lot of these problems in the larger social discourse and context, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. What's the process for the supervisees and being able to do that? Is it hard for them to see it in the beginning, but then they get to a place where they can see it everywhere? Or how does...
What I find now is that, like, so this group that I have right now, we just actually brought a bunch of them on as clinicians. So this group that I have right now, they always see the oppression now in the work that they're doing. Because, and I got this idea because of the way that I was trained, where I saw clients immediately through this lens because I had the lens first. So they have this, we start to discuss every client this way, and then they start to do it for themselves. It's like the way our clients work, right? That we give them language to do certain things, and then they start doing the work on their own. So they come in now with things that they want to talk about related to oppression. They come to that group ready. But this is what this client said to me. My client brought up the fact that, I'm trying to think something that somebody said to me. My client brought up the fact that I'm a white man, and this is like what it's like to say this to me. My client brought up the fact that, you know, as women, this is something that we go through. Because they make space for it in the room because they have this frame when they're even thinking about the clients at this point.
So yeah. So how do you think these questions, these lenses are changing the work that they're doing in the room in comparison if they were to adopt go do CBT or something like that? How do you think the work is looking different for them now that they've adopted these lenses?
I think they're joined with the clients in a way that they wouldn't be. Because the client understands, for example, and I think I said this earlier, when you are a person of color, you're very aware of who's a person of color and who isn't. You're aware that you're not supposed to talk about racism with white people. When you're a woman, you know that you don't complain about sexism with men because they don't always hear it. So they have therapists right now that actually make space in the room for these conversations to happen. So I think they have a much more complete view of their clients and the lives that they're living.
Wow. Okay. So it's been pretty powerful for everybody involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. That's fascinating. So how, I guess my next question would be how do you do this work with families? How have you taken the social justice lens into your work with families? You work at a center that works with a lot of families, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. I think that I didn't demonstrate to them pretty quickly that I understand how they're treated by larger systems. I understand how they're treated by all of the systems that impact their lives. So I work at a place where there's services everywhere, right? In the Bronx, they're all attached in some way to Medicaid. A lot of families are dealing with ACS, they're dealing with the police, like all these different systems that are constantly in their lives.
At play, right? Yeah.
And you know what I mean? So they understand by just the way that I have these discussions with them. I understand what their experience might be dealing with ACS. I understand what it's like to walk around a neighborhood where you don't really see police officers. You know what I mean? Or if you do see police officers, what does that mean? Like, I understand that because we talk about it. I bring it up. I say like, oh, I was walking on the road and this is what I saw. Like, so it's in the room.
Yeah. So, and do you find you have that same experience where they feel like they can have conversations with you that they might not otherwise be able to have? Any other context.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I guess some final questions for you. I'm wondering now, what do you do next with your work, or what are you thinking about? Are you going to continue to present your framework, or what's exciting you, I think, moving forward?
What's exciting me is that we have big picture and little picture. Little picture, we have new interns coming in. I'm excited to go through this whole process
again. That's great.
You know, so that is something I'm always looking forward to. Big picture, I like that every person that is trained this way, when they go out into the world, they share this with other people. I see, and I like that. Like that, we always say that like one person can't end oppression, right? But a bunch of us doing little things like this, I get excited when I see like my therapist here now doing this work, and then our clients are bringing in other people saying, oh, this is where you should go for therapy.
Oh, that's great.
Like that excites me. I like when I go like to an after conference and I say, I'm going to talk about oppression. And like so many people came to that workshop that like I ran out of
right.
You know, so like that's the stuff that excites me. That like we're maybe slowly changing the field a little bit. I like that more and more people are expressing an interest in understanding how oppression impacts our work.
That's great.
Because if we're not understanding it and we're kind of at the front line with people, like how are we really servicing our clients?
Right.
If we're missing like huge parts of them.
Huge parts, yeah. Are you going to be presenting at the next AFA conference?
I plan to.
That's great. Okay. So, and that'll be in Denver, and just a plug, that'll be in Denver in next June, right? So that'll be fun, and you should all come and see Laurel. Our listeners should come and see Laurel present. It'll be it'll be great. One final question for you. What's influencing your work these days? Who are you reading, or what are you thinking about, or what's capturing your attention these days?
The things that are I'm really fascinated by the Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter.
Okay.
And how indicative it is of silencing. It's something that seems so obvious when you understand it. And the people that I'm having these conversations with are like, well, obviously it's silencing. And then other people are just like, it absolutely is not, which is silencing right in that moment. Right. So things like that fascinate me. I'm excited about like politics and like how that's going to play out.
So you're, yeah, this is going to be a hot topic for your new interns, I imagine, coming in, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it will be whether they want to or not.
Right. About it, so it will be. Yeah. Anything else capturing your attention, or?
I'm excited about the new school year and to see what comes of it.
Me too. Okay, so Laurel, I want to just thank you for, I know you're busy. I know you're really busy, and I want to thank you for taking the time out of your middle of your day to chat with me here on The Radical Therapist.
This was fun. This was so much
fun. Good. I'm glad you felt that way. And I imagine I will see you next year in Denver
at the next time.
But I just for everybody that's listening, how might they find you or how might they contact you?
Okay, so I have a website. It's laurelsalmonlmft.com. All right, and I'm slowly, it's a fairly new website, so I'm slowly like adding stuff to it. Anybody can, there's a way to contact me.
Okay, and
my email.
Yeah, and just so our listeners know, the oppression theory, the Facilitating Oppression Conversations framework is on your blog, which is on your website.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'll also post links on our show notes so they can have them. But Laura, once again, thank you for coming to the show. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I look forward to attending your next workshop in Denver next year.
I look forward to seeing you, and thanks for having me. This was great.
Well, that's our show, and I want to once again thank you for listening, and please spread the word, tell a friend, and you can also help us once again by doing by going to iTunes, finding the Radical Therapist podcast, and rating and reviewing the show. We would really appreciate if you did that, and also you can contact me anytime, give me some feedback, tell me you want to be on the show, recommend somebody to be on the show. You can do that by sending me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And we're also have a website, theradicaltherapist.com. And I will also have Laurel's information in the show notes on the website. So if you want to track her down, you can do it that way. And also we're on Twitter at @theradtherapist and on Instagram at @theradicaltherapist. So lots of ways to find us. So please do. Please have a conversation with us and please give us some feedback. So once again, we really appreciate you listening. My name is Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist.